Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash Burnett. Hello and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes a look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany. I'm Aaron Gash Burnett, a journalist and security analyst specializing in German politics and foreign policy. And I'm here, as always, with my friend and co-host, Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow here at the Council and head of its action group, Zeitenwende. And we're coming to you from a very apt location, giving the theme that we're talking about today of our special, covering the pillars of Ukrainian victory. We're very pleased to be at the Leonard Mary Conference in Tallinn, in large part to hammer home an important message that Tallinn has, and we think Berlin needs to hear. And that is, once again, that our democratic values and security interests in Europe depend not on us supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes, as Olaf Scholz has said before, but with whatever it takes, as our Baltic friends keep reminding us. The outcome Washington and Berlin seem to favor, as suggested by the drip-drip of military support, the filling of the bucket of water Ukraine needs with tiny teacups over 2 years that Yaroslav Trofimov mentioned earlier this season. That favored outcome appears to be stalemate, but here in Tallinn, the goal is victory, isn't it, Ben?
Very much so, Aaron. But that means we have to ask the question, what is victory? What does victory actually look like? Does it mean overrunning Russia's forces, militarily actually expelling them, kicking them out from Ukraine? Or does it mean, as some analysts have recently suggested, changing Moscow's calculation so that continuing to fight the war is worse than stopping? And thus victory would mean, in a military sense at least, putting Ukraine in a good position to negotiate. But in both cases, how does that compare to where we are now? And the question we're going to be exploring with our guests today is, how do we get from that situation we're in now to either of those outcomes? So what is the theory of victory here? What is the goal and how do we actually get there? And it's important to ask, can we even still do that? Is that still actually a viable possibility? Is victory of either of those sorts still actually on the table? There are a lot of people around Europe and across the transatlantic area questioning that. If it's not, what's holding us back? If it is still on the table, what have we got to do to actually get there? And in any case, where does this leave us in terms of Ukraine, in terms of European security, in terms of NATO, and indeed the future of the free world, given that we are in a systemic competition where our credibility across the alliance and across the democratic world is at stake?
So, Ben, we know what our ideal goal is, and that's a goal that we personally share with our Estonian hosts. But for us to chart a way to get there, we need to know where we are. So what is the state of the battlefield situation in Ukraine right now?
So, Aaron, at the moment, Russia is advancing slowly and at enormous cost, thousands and thousands of dead and wounded each month, but they are advancing. Ukraine is holding on, determined to deny Russia new launching points for its powerful glide bombs that are wreaking carnage upon civilian targets close to the front line and which can be launched from up to 40 kilometers away. But we can also see that the delay with the US supplemental, as well as Europe's failure to step up in the meantime to actually fill that gap, has created a situation where Ukraine is not only very short on ammunition, outgunned by as much as 10 to 1 in artillery fire in some parts of the front, but also that it's not been able to rotate or rest its soldiers as much as it would like, which has limited the possibility for it to go on so-called active defense, local counterattacking that would make the Russian advance even more costly and begin to stabilize the front line. And that's also because of a lack of some crucial equipment, which hasn't been provided to Ukraine and which it can't at the moment source locally. So what we see at the moment is soldiers spread across a 1,000-kilometer front defending desperately, but not equipped to do so as they need to. We're also seeing air defense stretched increasingly thin. Now that the supplemental supplies and the new European packages are starting to arrive, it will help address some of that imbalance in firepower, but that's mainly going to raise the cost of Russia's advances rather than, and perhaps limit the territorial gains they can make rather than stopping them. So the question for this year is how much cost can be inflicted on Russia and how far can we stop them from getting, basically. According to Jack Watling of RUSI, an excellent article of whom you can find in the show notes, Russia is most likely to be at its most dangerous towards the end of this year. So there's a temporal dimension to this as well. And what Jack argues is that the supplemental coming through has bought Ukraine time to now actually re-equip itself, regenerate and reconstitute its forces in a way that would allow it to move to active defense and even go on the attack perhaps next year. So that's the situation that some analysts see at the moment. We're going to hear from our panelists in just a second if they think they agree with that situation, and also to ask how we get to that goal of victory.
So now that we've laid out where we stand, our Pillars of Victory special looks at two very important roads to victory that we must travel on simultaneously. One is military, as we've been laying out. One is financial and economic, which concerns proper sanctions enforcement, and in particular, seizing $300 billion in frozen Russian central bank assets and transferring them to Ukraine. We're going to get into that one, that economic bit, in part two of our special. But right now, we have some amazing guests with us here in Tallinn to help take us through what Ukrainian victory looks like on the battlefield and what it is going to take. Back by popular demand is a guest from one of Berlin Side Out's very first episodes. Welcome back to General Ben Hodges. He is the former commanding general for the U.S. Army in Europe. He's also been a prominent expert commentator on Russia's war against Ukraine and Ukraine's fight for freedom. You can find his contributions in think tanks and media across Europe and the U.S. Also joining us is Oleksandr Daniluk, the chairman of the Center for Defense Reforms in Ukraine and former chief advisor to Ukraine's Minister of Defense, amongst the many roles he's held in his career. He's also an expert in hybrid warfare, intelligence, and whole of society approaches to defense, among other fields. Welcome to the show. Welcome also to Ivo Dalder, former U.S. ambassador to NATO and CEO of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, who has authored or edited 10 books. And finally, we have Terry Schultz. She is a journalist and self-described NATO geek. That is two traits that I'm very happy that we share. She freelances for outlets like NPR and German public broadcaster Deutsche Welle on NATO, EU, and foreign policy topics. Welcome to part one of our Pillars of Victory special. Oleksandr, let's start with you. One thing we've heard from Ukrainians we've spoken to about the current defense situation is that it feels like time has gone backwards, that 2 years in, we're back to the basics of needing more air defense to protect civilians and infrastructure. But as Ben has pointed out on this show before, you don't win a war with air defense. So what's needed to solve this acutely, focusing on getting Ukraine the kit that it needs to win, to get back on the front foot?
So first of all, it's clear that Ukraine is not going to win by ultimate victory in Moscow. You know, it's completely clear because of nuclear weapon, it's not possible. So in this regard, the victory is, first of all, lack of ability to continue fighting this war, not just military, you know, means, but also like funds to support that military efforts, and also lack of will. So in this regard, it means that we have three dimensions. It's military dimension, economic dimension, and psychological dimension. And in case of psychological dimension, it's not only population as a whole, but like specific elites, including Putin. Because for Putin, this war is not a mean, but the goal, because actually, as long as he fights this war, he believes that he can still be in power. So in case of military dimension, I think that General Hodges can explain it much better than I can, but at the same time, just a few words. I think that in 2022, we had like almost five times or definitely four times less troops, Russian troops in Ukraine. And it was relatively, you know, easy to equip Ukraine to the level we could actually just achieve that decisive, you know, victory on the territory of Ukraine and restitute our internationally recognized borders. And at least on the mainland, I think, and to start operation in Crimea. And that's why, you know, assessments of a lot of experts, including General Hodges, were absolutely correct. It was possible. And for your understanding, it's still more or less the same situation we had in 2022. We have half of our armed forces which are not equipped at all because it's territorial defense forces, and they are not used for actually territorial defense forces missions, right? So they are used as a proper mechanized infantry, but they are not mechanized. And part of our mechanized brigades are not mechanized to the level they should be. So this is actually how we can improve the quality of Ukrainian troops immediately. Plus, of course, you know, the lack of air force aircraft specifically, it creates some unnecessary superiority Russians don't need to have. So in economic dimension, like I have to say the idea of oil price cap was a big failure because Russians made two times more money from oil in 2023 than in 2022, just because of growing prices on oil. So we should reduce that prices. And psychological dimension, we need to make this war unpopular for Russians. And it means that we need to have, you know, psychological offensive, at least, you know, to reduce the support of Russian people to this war. Thank you.
Thanks so much for that, Alexander. Ben, great to have you back on the show. Good to see you here in Tallinn.
Thanks for the privilege.
You've been one of the strongest voices for the position that Ukrainian victory is not only possible, but very necessary, and that the route to victory runs through Crimea. Could you talk us through that, about this theory of victory that you outline?
Well, first I have to say I disagreed with the way you set this up, whether it was either this or this, and those two sort of scenarios are not exclusive of each other. And I would also say we have not even tried yet. I mean, to be honest, my president, the German Bundeskanzler, they have not even said, we want Ukraine to win. And I mean, day one of any staff course is, what's the strategic objective? What are we trying to accomplish? And instead, we end up with policies that are in search of somewhere to hook into, and which is usually results in bad policy when you have senior people in the administration. And by the way, I want to be clear, the administration has done a superb job holding 50 nations together, you know, the amount of money that the United States has contributed. But that's not the measure that counts. What counts is, what are we providing towards what's needed to actually win? And to do that, you have to declare, we want to win, that it's in America's interest that Ukraine defeats Russia, which means kicking them out back to the 1991 borders. There's no need for one Ukrainian soldier to cross the border into Russia. There's no Ukrainians that want to go there. Yep. But we've got to give them the ability to kick Russia back to the 91 border. And so the three things that are needed to do that are, number one, declare that that's our policy, that it's in America's interest. I mean, while the Congress was shameful in taking so long, a small portion of the Congress was shameful in holding up the aid package, the fact is the president never reached out to the American people except one time and said, look, people in Missouri, California, Idaho, New York, Florida, it's in our economic interest. And plus, we don't want American soldiers having to go fight in Europe again. So we want the best way to keep NATO out of the war is to help Ukraine defeat Russia in Ukraine. And then, by the way, the Chinese are watching. So the best way to deter China is for the Chinese to see that the United States is prepared to do everything necessary to defend what we say are our values, the so-called international rules-based order, respect for sovereignty, respect for human rights, freedom of navigation, respect for international law, all those things that China, like Russia, wants to stomp on. If we can't do it in Europe, where we have so many advantages with geography and allies, it will be very difficult to do that in the Indo-Pacific region. So that's the first thing. The second thing, of course, and you mentioned Crimea. I think Crimea is the decisive terrain of this war. Of course, Putin wants to destroy Ukraine and the idea of Ukraine as a state. But in real terms, Crimea is what matters. I mean, it's not, with apologies to my Ukrainian friends that live in the Donetsk and Luhansk, he's done nothing to improve that place over the last 10 years. Nor will he do anything to improve that area. Crimea is what matters because of the ports, its ability to dominate the entire Black Sea. So if we can help Ukraine make Crimea untenable for Russian forces so that the Russian Navy cannot sail out of Sevastopol, so that Russian Air Force cannot launch attacks from any of the many bases there or launch drones, and of course the huge logistics site at Zhankoy, which supports all of Russia's activities in the southern part of Ukraine, make all that go away. I mean, there's nowhere to hide. Every square meter of Crimea is within range of a TACMS or Taurus. And the Brits, the Ukrainians have already proven the concept with just three British storm shadows, the Russian Black Sea Fleet headquarters destroyed and the dry dock. And my Navy friends are astounded that I, as an Army infantry soldier, know what a dry dock is or why it matters. But without that, the Navy, the Black Sea Fleet can't operate. So they've already proven the concept. So clearly define strategic objective. Then you can have good policies about what we're going to provide. And not this nonsense about, you can't use American weapons to shoot into Russia. That's incredible to me. I mean, we're saying that at the same time that Russian missiles are slamming into Ukrainian apartment buildings. And then the third thing, of course, is we've got to remove all doubt about ammunition. I mean, it's incredible to me that the combined economies of Europe plus Canada, U.S., and U.K. dwarfs Russia, whose economy is somewhere close to the size of Spain. Why is this even a question?
Absolutely. And that's something we've argued an awful lot on the show, is that indeed it's not as long as it takes. It's not even actually whatever it takes, because if we don't define the it, then we don't know where we're going. And so that's the goal there, which I think this is missed in a lot of the discourse, which is why we wanted to have this discussion today about victory. And you're right, but it's not only the Biden administration. The Scholz government, as you mentioned, has also not said clearly that Ukraine should win. So when you say we've not even tried, Ben, I would agree with that. But Ivo, why is it that we're not trying? And would you share that assessment?
We haven't. Well, first of all, great to be on the show. And as always, I'm not going to improve on Ben's knowledge of Navy dockyards. And I
can assure our listeners he wasn't even looking at his phone when he was talking about the dry dock.
And I was talking about dockyards. So there you go. And it makes sense. But the question is, and by the way, it's not just Scholz or Biden, it's Macron as well, who has said that the defeat of Russia is an existential to Europe, but he hasn't said the victory of Ukraine is. And defeat and victory are sometimes defined in slightly different ways. Why haven't they? You'd have to ask them, and I certainly don't speak for either of them. I think part of it is a belief that in order to defeat Russia, you will have to take military steps that may lead Russia to do things that we don't want them to do, escalate in ways that we don't accept or could tolerate, and risks the possibility of us getting directly engaged in this war. And I think fundamentally, in an even larger question that Ben answered is, what does victory mean beyond the reconstitution of Ukraine's territorial independence and sovereignty based on 1991 borders? Victory fundamentally means that war is no longer an option to resolving whatever differences exist between Russia and Ukraine. I think part of the debate has been too focused on the military dimension of this and not enough focused on the political dimension. And to some extent, I personally see a trade-off, although neither Scholz nor Biden sees the trade-off. I think Ukraine will be secure only if it is a member of NATO. And that therefore, the question of security, and by that I mean that it can itself define its own future as a member of NATO, Russia will no longer be willing to attack it. The question is, does that security extend all the way to the 1991 borders or not? And if so, what do you need to do militarily to achieve the reconstitution of those borders or not? Or can you do it politically over time? That, by way, is, I think, the debate we should be having. Because there's two ways to do this. Militarily, you can reconstitute the territory, but then you still have a political question, what happens to Ukraine? And I would argue a Ukraine that is not a NATO, that has reconstituted all of its territory, is not a pleasant country to have in the middle of Europe. Give you an example. If Ukraine has to provide for its own security by itself because it is not a member of NATO, it will acquire capabilities to make sure that it provides that capability. And it will behave in ways that will make security more tolerant for it by making its neighbors less secure. We actually have an actor on the world stage who's acted like this for the last 70 years. It's called Israel. Israel does not have security alliances, not an ally of the United States, although we just defended them against an Iranian missile attack, which apparently we can do with Israel but not with Ukraine. Don't ask me why, but secondly and importantly, Israel has nuclear weapons. It's ultimate guarantee. And wasn't it us who asked the Ukrainians to give up nuclear weapons so we would then make sure that its border would be held? And if without NATO, without thinking through how you bring the security of Ukraine and make it our security, we're going to be facing that question, quite apart from whether Crimea is living hell or unlivable hell for the Russians there.
That's right, Ivo. And that's actually, though, another way that we're going back to the debates of last year, because even in a policy brief for DGAP, I argued that very point last year, that we will not make Ukraine safe unless it's in NATO. Why are the porcupine, hedgehog, Israel options not applicable, etc.? But after the Vilnius summit, we don't see the will to actually bring Ukraine in, and we don't think it's going to happen at the Washington summit either.
Well, I think that's true, no doubt about it. However, the reality is that there is no consensus within NATO on bringing a country into the alliance that isn't actively fighting and at war. At Vilnius, we weren't talking about that either. We were talking about an invitation, which is meaningless, strategically meaningless, because it is a piece of paper that is as good as a communique that the NATO has issued for the last 16 years. The only thing that is meaningful is membership, not an invitation, not accession, not yapping, yapping, yapping. It's membership. And the reality is, how do you get to membership? You need to figure out a way to end this war. And whether that ends in a war that is defined as victory or ends in a war, it ends the fighting in a way that says we find this territorial ceasefire for today acceptable. If the rest then becomes part of NATO, it becomes a trade-off that is worth discussing, at least to have a discussion that we can have with the Ukrainians, not the Russians. We can have with the Ukrainians. And that's the kind of thing that Karen Donford and I just wrote about in Foreign Affairs, and I've been arguing since the beginning of this war. NATO membership is what this is about. That's why the Russians went to war. So why don't we make that part of victory?
So, Terry, I'd like to ask you a question about dry docks and attackums.
Great, I studied up.
Yeah, good.
Got my notes right here.
I want to follow up on this point. Terry, in Berlin just this week, we heard from a senior German government official that there's even no consensus on getting a divided Ukraine into NATO. There's questions that they raise the comparison to the Minsk period, where ceasefire violations repeatedly happening mean that we just can't take that risk. And we pushed back on this argument, it has to be said, but it would be nice to hear from you where you think the debate stands on getting Ukraine into NATO and how.
Well, just in the half day that I've been here in Tallinn, I've heard both sides of this argument, with some people here, even at the conference, arguing for a formula like has been promoted by Anders Fogh Rasmussen, former NATO Secretary General, that you bring in Ukraine without having control of Crimea. Again, as Ben says, Donbass is much less important, but that you allow Crimea to remain under Russian control and somehow bring in a fragmented Ukraine and help protect that part of Ukraine, tell Ukraine that you will help reinforce that area on an abrogated Article 5 agreement, which I don't see how you make that happen, but that's in fact what the so-called Rasmussen plan suggests. And I brought that up in an on-the-record discussion today with the Secretary General of the Estonian Foreign Minister, Jonathan Vseviov, and he said, we're not even going to discuss bringing in Ukraine without Crimea, because as soon as you start doing that, you let Russia believe that that is not the goal anymore. So you're stuck. It's really a dilemma. And this is, it's not surprising that NATO, as now 32 countries, can't come to an agreement on that. You don't even have experts who can speak freely coming to an agreement on this. How do you leave Crimea behind? As Ben says, you don't. You can't. I always thought the Rasmussen plan was incomprehensible as to how you protect the rest of Ukraine when you have Russian soldiers there staring right across the border of Crimea. So, I mean, other people are perhaps you can answer that militarily, and maybe people can answer that politically. But as someone on the outside asking the questions, I don't see how either of those makes sense.
Let's come to the political dimension of Crimea for a second. We'll start with you, Ivo, and then please, the rest of you, feel free to come in on it as well. Why does Crimea seem to occupy this very interesting psychological space in the minds of our leaders? Olaf Scholz is very nervous about hitting the Kerch Bridge, for example. It's one of the reasons that is thought why he doesn't want to deliver Taurus. It seems to occupy this space in our minds and in political minds that the Donbass doesn't. For example, what explains this? This idea that Crimea has a higher escalation risk attached to it than anywhere else.
I think the belief is sort of underscored by our reaction or non-reaction in 2014 that Russia has some form of claim on Crimea that is more understandable, although continues to be illegitimate, than it may have on other parts of Ukraine. There's a history there. We can go into delve in the history, but clearly, the way that the West, the United States, Germany, other countries reacted to the annexation of Crimea in 2014 was not of the same kind as we saw after 2022. And in fact, the sanctions that were imposed in 2014 only came after the shoot down of the Malaysian airliner. And even then, some of us, many of us, were arguing for lethal aid to provide it to the Ukrainians, and both Chancellor Merkel and President Obama opposed it. So this is a longstanding kind of view. I do want to take issue, whether it's with Rasmussen or Terry or whoever doesn't
it's
like.
It's Rasmussen, definitely.
Well, so I actually don't – I don't think that what Rasmussen is saying is that Crimea should not be part of NATO. I think what he is saying is that Article 5 should not apply to the territory of NATO, a position that I would agree with, that is, if in fact you bring in a country – you bring in the entire country, but how you defend which part of it is something that you politically decide. We have done this before. In the case of Germany, we brought West Germany into NATO in 1955 with the explicit understanding that East Germany was not part of NATO, West Berlin was not part of NATO, and that Germany would not use military force in order to lead to the reunification of Germany. The United States has a bilateral security agreement with Japan that does not include a commitment to defend the northern territories explicitly in the treaty, and it doesn't mean that the United States that the treaty and U.S. recognition does not include the northern territories. So the question of how you deal with occupied territories, if and when you have a country in NATO, is a separate. Analytically and frankly politically separate question than whether or not you bring the country into NATO.
If I could just clarify, I meant to say that he would say bring it in before you have Crimea back. Do not wait until Crimea is under Ukraine.
I'm on the
control.
Record for saying that too. I think we should bring all of Ukraine in. Doesn't mean that Article 5 necessarily needs to apply to all of Ukraine, but it could apply only to the territory that, quote, is administered by Ukraine, which means that as that territory changes hands, politically presumably, the obligation comes with it directly.
Right. And this, I mean, NATO without Article 5 is not the NATO that anyone wants, quite frankly speaking. It's not the NATO that's worth what we know NATO to be. But Ben, in Berlin...
Again, I'm not saying you have NATO with Article 5. That is not a NATO. And an article and the argument that some have made that Article 5 should be only, you know, air defenses or something like that is equally ridiculous. You need to have a real Article 5 in which you defend whatever territory it is that you declare you will defend.
Indeed. Now, Ivo, let me just come to what you said a second ago, because you mentioned Berlin. Now, again, this is not something that the Germans are considering at the moment. Across the political spectrum, there's nervousness about this. There are some who we work with closely from our action group, Zeitenwende, who have been very clear about getting Ukraine into NATO. But Ben Hodges, there's not a lot of support for this in Germany. And that's a little bit ironic, given the historical parallel that Ivo just drew, and the fact that even though there was a special status for Berlin, there were American soldiers stationed there, and their job was to be willing to die in order to act as that tripwire defense to bring others in. What's your take on that?
Well, Germany needs to regain self-confidence, first of all, and not be afraid to be bold and step forward. They've been hiding, maybe it's too harsh, but hiding behind their history. There's a pacifist streak, and it's also pretty convenient where they've been for the last several decades. And so they have not done what accepted responsibility as the most powerful economic country in Europe and would potentially could be one of the best armed forces in Europe. So this is about political will. Chancellor Scholz, I think, is unwilling to provide Taurus really because, you know, Germany has no nuclear weapon. The French and British have nuclear weapons. The United States does. And I think Chancellor Scholz is very concerned that Germany could somehow end up in a conflict and then would be threatened by Russia without Germany having its own nuclear deterrent. So this is where the United States, this is part of declaring what does victory look like, where we should make it very clear. First of all, we're going to give Ukraine everything they need to win. And Germany, don't you worry, the U.S. nuclear shield is sacrosanct. So that remove that as a concern that Chancellor Scholz has. Of course, Chancellor Scholz has his own left flank he has to deal with as well. But look, I have to say there is so much time and intellectual energy wasted, in my view, on what are parlor games about, well, you know, if you divide up this part or we can figure out a way to get around it. What happened to saying this is in our interest and you combine the economies and militaries of all the West, the 50 nations already, it dwarfs whatever Russia on its best day could ever muster. Why are we scared to actually win something? Eva was correct. I think there is concern about Russia escalation, which really means Russian use of a nuclear weapon. And while, yes, they have thousands of nuclear warheads, clearly they don't care how many people they kill, including their own, they're not going to use a nuclear weapon. There's, I would say, almost zero chance that they will use a nuclear weapon because there's zero benefit to using a nuclear weapon. It's only the threat that makes us all kind of stutter step and halt and like, oh, I don't know.
Right, and this is exactly the political blackmail backed up by the nuclear saber-rattling that we overcame in the Cold War because we believed in ourselves and we get the correct collective spine stiffening.
It's got to be American leadership. The administration has got to do this. And then I think other allies that care about these values will feel more confident in saying, absolutely. I can tell you what, if Ukraine fails, Poland is not going to hide behind the Vistula River. They're going to move into Western Ukraine. They're not going to sit there and wait for the Russians just to keep coming. Romania has already said they will protect Moldova. So if Ukraine fails, you've got potentially two NATO countries that will take steps to defend their interests. And there'll be a few more million refugees, Ukrainians, heading into Germany. So I don't understand this reluctance to act decisively, defeat Russia in Ukraine, and it will solve European security problems for decades. I don't know why we're scared of that.
We've been arguing the same on the show repeatedly.
Well, obviously, we're all not very compelling in our arguments.
We need to break through the bubble. And this is what is behind the question before. How do we actually get over this reluctance there? Because, I mean, Ben, you echoed points that we've been making, that Elliot Cohen's been making, about this need to declare that victory is in our interest. This is about European security, and European security is in Americans' interest. It's in Germans' interests, and yet that's still not breaking through. And Alexander, you talk about this whole of society approach to defense, which has become very clear in Ukraine. What lessons can Europeans actually learn from that? What do they need to know about what happens in these situations as Russia is created in Ukraine to understand the threat that they're actually under?
Yeah, I think that I will answer a completely different question if you don't mind. So I think that what is actually super important is how to neutralize this nuclear threat problem. And I think that there is a very easy, you know, way to do that. And we need just two countries, US first and UK second, who signed that agreement with Ukraine in 1993, according to which Ukraine abandoned the third nuclear arsenal in the world. And Russia actually signed it as well and respected all of our borders, including Crimea. So that's why, like, we didn't have any territorial dispute with them, right? So they have no justifications. And it should be a very simple step. Like, US should say that, like, guys, like, nuclear option is not acceptable. And Ukraine has actually this security agreement with us. If you use any nukes against Ukraine, you will be nuked by us. This is very simple. And I absolutely fully agree with General, and he's absolutely right. Russians are not going to use any nukes or even conventional weapon against NATO. They actually reduced all of their provocations they had, you know, for many, many years because they are scared. So that's why this is step one. Step two, from NATO in Washington, we need to say that it's not like we are going to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. It should be a very clear message, like, every step to escalate, every additional penny in the Russian budget to support Ukraine will mean that NATO will give Ukraine 3-5 times more immediately, just immediately. And that should be, again, security agreement between Ukraine and NATO. And it will make no sense for Putin to, you know, to continue fighting this war. Because, like, again, in the beginning, he was reluctant, he was not sure, and he dared to invade Ukraine just because of fail of deterrence, because the West wasn't actually solid enough, right? And the same story with that total war approach. So for more than actually 6 months, Putin was sitting and thinking about what to do, and only after he saw that self-limitation, self-censorship of the self of the West, he decided that it's actually possible to win, and he actually just increased that, you know, number of troops and started that industrial mobilization as well as recruitment of that hundreds of thousands of people. So it should be very clear message in Washington that Russia is not going to win and Russia has no capabilities to win, and nuclear option is not on the table anymore.
Terry, I want to come to you about that, because we've heard around the table this entire episode about the value of U.S. leadership and also the fact that the president's communication on this has been a bit lacking. We had one big speech about it, as you referred to earlier. You know, rather than ask about what, you know, could have happened or should have happened, can the president and the administration come back and turn this around and basically communicate to the people, this is in our interest, this is in the American interest as well as European interest? And if he can, how does he do that, in your view?
So what I see is the effect at NATO and in Brussels, also across town and at the European Union, of the U.S. not having done that. So somebody who lives in the U.S. could probably, and analyzes U.S. politics for a living, could probably answer that a bit better than I could. But I can definitely see that this is something that European countries are worried about. And in fact, I just asked a Baltic leader, you know, why haven't the populations in the U.S. Under threat of, for example, a Trump presidency and what that might do to decimate NATO, why haven't they mobilized as they did when they wanted their countries to become members of NATO? You know, in the early 90s, when you had the Baltic populations, the Polish populations, very much taking an active political role to get these countries under Article 5, you have not seen them now activate themselves in the United States against the Trump threats to NATO. And I was told that they've assimilated now and they no longer feel that that's their battle. So I'd be interested in Ivo's take, because he's there in Chicago with plenty of Poles and Lithuanians. And why doesn't the American population identify with the need for a strong NATO and the need to protect Ukraine?
I mean, it's a very important question. NATO has become politicized in the United States, and that is one of the consequences of the Trump presidency. Pew has just done a recent poll, which has been stunning, and we at the Chicago Council do polling on NATO and have shown that for a long time. Overall, Americans are very pro-NATO. They have a positive attitude towards NATO. So the question that Pew asked is, do you have a positive or negative attitude toward NATO? 60% said positive, 30% said negative. But here's the but. Conservative Republicans, 59% negative, 39% positive. Liberal Democrats, 85% positive, 11% or so negative. So you now have the full politicization of NATO in the United States. I would urge the Baltic leaders to talk to their diaspora, as I would anybody else, about the importance, Ukrainian leaders and others, to actually understand that there is a threat to their homeland's security, including the United States, because a weakened NATO is not good for the United States. I think the administration should be making that case much more strongly. I agree that the administration seems to think that if Tony Blinken gives a speech in Kyiv, by the way, very good one, that is
maybe better than the guitar.
Maybe better, yeah. Well, that's a different story. But giving a speech in Kyiv, or indeed as he did in Helsinki a year ago, or the president did in Helsinki and in Poland a year ago, that they are then speaking to the American public. They're not. This is a speech that needs to be given in Missoula. It needs a speech that needs to be given in Lubbock, Texas.
And not a speech, engagement in a different way.
But it is a conversation that needs to be had with Americans on a day-to-day basis. I know, Ben, for example, that's one of the things you're doing. You're talking to Americans about NATO, about Ukraine, about what matters. But for some reason, governments are incredibly bad. And this is not just the U.S. government or this particular administration. Just governments are incredibly bad talking to their own people about what it is that they are doing when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, we sit here in Tallinn, where the government has not been bad at doing that, just to the south, in Latvia and in Lithuania. We see some of the clearest communicators we have in Europe, real leaders showing leadership. And all of us around the table have been saying should. So what are the obstacles that we have to overcome to get from should to did?
You know, in January 1942, Churchill came to Washington, D.C., and U.S. Navy ships were still on fire in Pearl Harbor from the Japanese attack. Great Britain had suffered 2.5 years of loss after loss after loss after loss to Nazi Germany and to Japan, Empire Japan. And no Americans wanted to get involved in a war in Europe again. In fact, half of America's population were first or second generation European immigrants, did not want to go back. But yet, Churchill and Roosevelt recognized what was at stake, huge stakes. And they agreed, had to defeat Germany first And then they, because they couldn't afford to lose Great Britain for the war effort for geographical reasons, and also they would need the resources of the British Empire to eventually defeat the Empire of Japan. So these two leaders agreed on a strategic priority, Germany first. And then they could turn to their populations, and this is, there was no internet, I mean, it was radio and newspapers, and they could talk to their population and say, look, this is what's at stake. We're going to have to mobilize our industry. We're going to have to grow armies, navies, and air forces to defeat the threat. And there was no reason for optimism, but yet they had the clarity and understanding what was at risk. And then they had the willingness and ability to communicate to their populations as if they were adults. And then 1 year later at the Casablanca Conference, and that first conference was the Arcadia Conference, 1 year later in January 1943, Casablanca Conference, again, not much reason for optimism. I mean, you know, continuing to lose or had not been able to turn the tide yet. And now they come up, they decide on a strategic outcome, end state, unconditional surrender. No bullshit, we want to get into a better negotiating position with Hitler, okay, or we'll let him keep parts of Europe. No, unconditional surrender. We're going to crush Nazi Germany. We're going to crush the Empire of Japan.
And your historical parallel, which is great, suggests there's another historical parallel and an opportunity. When you want to talk about opportunities, the historical parallel I've been thinking about is 1999, the last time NATO had a summit in Washington, which was the 50th anniversary summit in Washington. We came there to celebrate the new members, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic, who had just weeks before gone there. But Tony Blair came to that summit after giving a speech in Chicago, of all places, and went to the Oval Office and spent 3.5 hours talking to President Clinton about the war that NATO was then engaged in Kosovo. And it wasn't going well. The air war was not achieving what it was supposed to achieve. Remember, that war was supposed to be over in a couple of days. You know, bit of bombing and the Serbs would leave. Well, they didn't leave. And they had a very serious discussion about a ground invasion, which NATO didn't formally agree to, but informally General Clark did. Sakyr was tasked by the NATO Secretary General to begin planning for a ground invasion. And we now know that that discussion had two consequences. One, there was serious planning for a ground invasion. It might have happened. And secondly, the Russians read this and said, oh, my God, we don't want to have that. If that happened, we don't want to have NATO having a ground invasion in quote, our part of the world, and started seriously engaging in a negotiation, which then led to the end of that war, not the end of the conflict, which, by the way, still goes on. Washington offers that same opportunity. And in some ways, although we will look back at the 6 months, and you can argue 2 years, but certainly the 6 months that we didn't support the Ukrainians as a critical turning point, what's happening in Ukraine today in terms of the bombing of cities, what's happening on the ground in the Kharkiv region and other regions is posing the question for the first time, first time since the beginning of this war, oh my God, Ukraine may lose. You can't have a NATO 75th anniversary summit and not address the possibility of that losing. And so I think there will be leaders, it may be Macron, it may be the Baltic leaders, it may be Tusk, it may be others, Sunak, who all of a sudden decides that maybe this is his way to win an election. Who knows? It's not going to be Olaf Scholz, but it will be somebody who will say, we need to have a serious discussion here at this summit about how we're going to achieve what we need to achieve, which is to make sure that Ukraine wins at this war. And this is an opportunity to do that. Will it happen? Nobody's talking about it now because nobody wants to talk about it. That doesn't mean it won't happen. This is not what the Secretary General gets to say. These are individual leaders who will come to a meeting and make and lead in a way that, frankly, on this issue, as on so many other issues, they don't until they do.
Right. And this is the point. You're never given opportunities to lead. You take them. And this is about creating that moment. And that's where I think some of those leaders I mentioned before from these smaller NATO states who have been incredibly clear-eyed about this in the beginning have a chance to rhetorically take the lead on that. Working against that is the desire for unity and lowest common denominator unity, which is, of course, what the Biden administration and the Scholz government are pushing for and are really making an effort at that. Note to our viewers in Germany or our listeners in Germany, it's interesting that the assessment of Rishi Sunak doing something is higher than that of Olaf Scholz doing something. And personally, I put the chances of Sunak doing something at zero.
It actually isn't grandstanding, which is what most leaders have been really good at. That's what undermines unity. What is using the opportunity of a serious conversation. That's what Blair did. What Blair did is he sat down with his good friend Bill Clinton and he convinced him that they needed to think about this differently. That's the kind of leadership you need. And actually, we may have someone, the new NATO Secretary General, who can do it quietly. That's the kind of people that you need in order to do this. Yes, it would be great if Olaf Scholz did it. Frankly, it would be great if Joe Biden did it. But they're facing political issues that are bigger right now. I mean, you'll come off of a debate with Donald Trump 2 weeks before the NATO summit, and so his view is a little different. So you need leaders like that.
You do. Now, Terry, let me come to you on that.
Well, you had a leader who could walk in and make people change their mind, and his name is Volodymyr Zelensky. At every NATO meeting, you have the Zelensky effect. You're not getting this until he walks in and he walks out, and suddenly, you know, there go the tanks, there go the F-16s, there goes more air defense. But he's not a member of NATO. And remember how he was humiliated at Vilnius when he came in and you know, dared to ask for more and was told that he wasn't grateful enough. And we all heard those stories about how he was humiliated for this kind of, you know, saying we need more of this, we need more of that.
Because he didn't do it quietly. He did it through Twitter, which is not the way in which you get your stuff done. So, again, Tony Blair didn't do that.
Do you blame the man for doing everything he can? Honestly, for trying to get there any way
Terry,
he can?
I am not blaming them. I'm talking about if you want to have effect, you can do it by doing it publicly and feel good. Or sometimes you can do it quietly and not take the credit.
Fair enough. I'm not a diplomat for obvious reasons. But he's the guy who was making people change their mind. And it hasn't gotten anyone where they need to be right now to help Ukraine win.
And indeed, it shouldn't be about us begging for the or having to be begged to do this. This is in our interest.
Hey, that's the point. It's our interest. And it should be easy for the President of the United States to explain to voters why it's in our interest. A disruption of Ukrainian food supplies to the world jacks up American food prices. It affects prices everywhere. I mean, basic economic things like this. So the president, with 50 years of political experience, ought to know how to speak to voters about these kinds of issues. And I'm just dumbfounded why he and his team have been unwilling to do that.
One more economic point. I'm an ammo geek in addition to a NATO geek, and I cannot fathom why this need for ammunition, where so much of the money goes to ammunition manufacturers, European weapons producers, ramping up production puts more money in the producers' pockets. The governments know that there will be a long-term need for this, and still joint procurement has stalled. It doesn't work.
That's right. And there's a link to it in our show notes to an article by Moritz Schularik, the German economist who heads the Kiel Institute for World Economy, talking about how Germany can actually solve its economic woes and its military woes in one fell swoop by taking the kind of actions Terry just mentioned.
Before we finish up, I'd like to come back to the point of leadership that you were talking about earlier, Ivo. And I will take an issue with one thing that you said, which is that you don't get anywhere by shaming people. When we look at Germany, yes, shame sometimes works. The shame will continue until the policy improves. So one aspect that I'd actually like to bring up in terms of where the German government at the moment is getting a certain amount of shame. Alexander, you talked about resources, the simple easy fact of resources. The reality is that we're currently sitting on a $300 billion war chest in frozen Russian assets that we do not have the political will so far to use. And Germany is one of the big laggards on this particular question. So let's just ask this in terms of, you know, when we look at resources, this war chest, if we actually decided to seize this, if we actually decided that we were going to try to win, really try to win, as Ben was saying earlier, What are some of the military implications of actually having those extra resources? What could you do with that?
I have to say that 300 billions of US dollars of Russian resource would change the situation on the battlefield, you know, immediately, just immediately. It would be more than 10 times more stuff for Ukrainian armed forces. And again, most of that stuff would be actually bought in your countries, which is good for your economies. But at the same time, it was like several good historical comparisons, and I would love, you know, to give you one more. So we're looking for that role model to win this war. And it was actually, I believe, one of that wars which to some extent could be considered as that role model for this war. It's Vietnam War. So like despite of that public, you know, like traditional, you know, reaction. Everyone believes that that was guerrilla warfare and other things. But in fact, it was North Vietnam controlled by North Vietnamese, you know, government, fully supported by Soviet Union and China, with the most modern at that time aircrafts, the most modern AD systems, the most modern, you know, ATGMs and a lot of other things, including 17,000 Russian troops on the ground, including some Soviet pilots, some Soviet crew for AD systems, etc. Ukraine doesn't need actually that personnel because Ukraine is actually very good in using that systems itself. Pretty often, actually, it's not worse than our Western colleagues. So that was a combination of two factors. One of them, like the most modern weapon given to North Vietnam by Soviets and Chinese. And in parallel, it was a huge, you know, psychological, political warfare operation in the U.S. to make this war absolutely unpopular, as well as the campaign in other countries, not just in NATO countries, but also in the countries of the global south. This is exactly what we have to use in Ukraine, and this is how we're going to win. And there is no other option, but we also have to be honest with ourselves that peaceful coexistence with people like Putin, Patrushev, Shoigu, and others, it's not in interest of the next generation. So it means that we have to finish this idea of peaceful coexistence with pure evil in the global world. So it means that we have to create the preconditions for liberation of Russia and countries like Russia, because otherwise our kids, our grandkids will be endangered.
Right. And this is, as Terry mentioned, Volodymyr Zelensky has been one of the great communicators of these issues. And speaking to Congress back in December 2022, he said exactly that. This is about the world we want our grandkids to be able to live in. Is that a world of freedom or not? And we have to be able to connect that to our populations in order to put the pressure on our politicians to step up and actually do the things that all of our expert guests have said we should today. Thank you, Ivo, Alexander, Ben, Terry, for joining us today in Tallinn. It's been a pleasure to talk to you all about this and about how we pave the way to Ukrainian victory.
Thank you very much to our panelists for joining us today to discuss the military dimension of Ukraine's victory. Stay tuned for part two of our Pillars of Victory special, which we alluded to just now with that question about $300 billion in frozen Russian assets, where we discuss how to win on the financial front. Till then.